Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll talk to the now former head of the state's Commission on Boxing and MMA about his tenure. And we'll meet a Valley couple who collect presidential memorabilia. But first, it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
People have continually asked me to not move this amendment. To what hill do you die on? And I choose you. I choose you as my hill to die on. I'm sorry this is happening to you. With my whole heart.
Today we send a message to every parent in Arizona. We see you, we hear your concerns, and we're taking action to protect your children. To every student, you deserve clean, safe food, and now you'll get it. And to other states watching what we've done here, follow Arizona's lead.
They're a company that is here, they want to stay here, they are creating jobs, and not only that, they are now helping to address the affordable housing crisis by using the state land that they bought to build housing to house their workforce.
We have adopted secularism as the religion of our country, and we need to work against that.
The best way of getting these agreements is not by threatening our allies, not by bullying our allies, but by sitting at the table and having trade negotiations.
And joining me to talk about the governor issuing a moratorium on new bills, the debate over a measure on Axon's proposed new campus, and more are Paul Bentz of HighGrad. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Great to be here.
So, Paul, let me start with you on the latest ratcheting up of this controversy over funding for the Division of Developmental Disabilities. This has been going on for a few weeks now. It's slated to run out of money in just a couple of weeks now if it doesn't get an infusion of cash. Both the House and Senate Appropriations Committee held hearings this week on a bill that would give the agency the money to do this, but it came with a number of other restrictions that Democrats and the governor and some Republicans also don't like.
Sure. I mean, one of the challenges was that there was a bipartisan solution on the table, and instead of adopting that, the chairman added three additional legislators to the panel just to ensure that it wouldn't succeed. And some of the cuts that they're proposing, including cutting parents' time that they can be paid to help take care of their children in half, is some of the things that the governor has stood for. And now she's evoked what some folks are calling the nuclear option. She is saying that until this issue gets solved, she's going to veto every bill that comes across her desk.
Yeah, Sam, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of bad will and bad blood on each side of this one.
Absolutely. And I think what's really unfortunate is there are real people in the middle of it, right? These are tens of thousands of families and individuals that require extraordinary care, and their parent caregivers are there to do that. And it's not because they're looking for an extra couple of bucks. It's because there aren't people who know the child and know the care that these children require. And what's happened is legislative leaders at the Capitol have really turned this into a very unfortunate football. It was an issue that needed to be addressed. And there were some real honest and serious solutions on the table. And I think the fact that those weren't taken up with, you know, integrity, I think says a lot about the state of affairs at the Capitol.
Sam, I want to ask you about the issue that Paul brought up, which was that the House Republican leadership added members to the Appropriations Committee essentially to make sure that this amendment by Representative Julie Willoughby, we heard from her in tears during the montage there, to make sure that her amendment, which had bipartisan support, would not pass. This is something that we see from time to time at the Capitol, right? Like members are added to committees for particular reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, just a couple other things that I would say there. One, this is an issue area and a policy area that Representative Willoughby knows. Healthcare and Human Services is one that she's really dedicated a lot of her time and energy and understanding in her tenure at the Capitol. But the other thing that's interesting is Representative Willoughby is not a rank and file backbencher. She is the whip of the majority caucus. So not only did she bring a serious bipartisan proposal to the table to be considered in that committee, she was rolled by her own leadership, and she is in leadership. I think that what, you know, is going to happen over the course of the next few days and weeks in response to that action is going to be very interesting to see.
Yeah, that could be really interesting. It's a good point that Representative Willoughby is in leadership. And as Sam said, her own leadership did not support her on this.
That's right. And it's just one of the things that folks are really sort of fed up with when you look at the legislative shenanigans. Only 35% of the electorate think the state is headed in the right direction. And this is one of the things that we see, not focused on the issues that matter most. Dealing with this issue and moving on to the other items of the day seems like it'd be an easy fix, bipartisan slam dunk, and be willing to say, like, these are the things we can get together on and agree on so that the differences play out. But, you know, Republicans are not wasting this opportunity. They're making a point about it, and they're trying to use it as leverage. Meanwhile, things like Prop 123, the budget itself, those issues are not being addressed because we're mired in these types of controversy where they're playing games.
Well, so let's talk about the governor's step here, which she took, which other governors before her have taken. I mean, Governor Brewer said, don't send me any bills, I'll veto them, when she was waiting for a budget and Medicaid expansion. Governor Ducey, of course, did this as well. He actually did veto a bunch of bills while waiting for a budget. Governor Hobbs had said, if the budget has already been sent to me, those are excluded. Those don't count. If you send me anything new, I'm going to veto them. Does she get her way on this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a smart move by the governor. We've seen other governors use it, Republican governors, so it's hard to decry it.
And it tends to work.
It does, and they also they are decrying it. And, you know, Livingston said some things about her in her ivory tower drinking wine or something like that. It's gotten to the level here where she's done what, you know, folks has already said is the nuclear option. It's generally really effective. And so she's going to take action on the bills that arrived before yesterday. And then now from here on out, she's basically challenging them to forward things. Democrats took it a step further by actually voting no on things that they might even wanted to support in solidarity with the governor.
Well, so, Sam, we heard just before Representative David Livingston, the chair of the Appropriations Committee, saying she's not going to get her way. So, like, something's got to give here.
Yeah, I think that it's really easy to believe that when you have the gavel in a certain moment of time. But I'm not sure that Chairman Livingston is going to get his way either. I think that there's going to be perhaps solutions that we haven't even discussed publicly at the legislature or around the legislature that are going to start to show themselves in the coming days and weeks.
I mean, it kind of has to happen in the coming days, right? I mean, the money runs out at the end of the month.
Absolutely. It is an urgent need. I was more kind of speaking to the fact that I think the power position and the kind of the puffing of the chest of saying the governor's not going to get her way is not going to bear well for any future conversations. As Paul mentioned, we still have, you know, an $18 billion budget to negotiate. We have, you know, education funding that faces a fiscal cliff coming up here shortly. And there's a lot of big, important issues that we need to be discussing. And this should have been taken care of 3 months ago when it was first identified as an issue.
One more thing on this I want to ask you guys about, which is that recall petitions have been taken out against four members of the House, the House Speaker, Steve Montenegro, the Majority Leader, Michael Carbone, and Representative David Livingston, and also the Chairman of the House Health Committee, Matt Gress. Sam, like we've only had one lawmaker actually recall. That was Russell Pierce after SB 1070. This seems like a particularly steep hill to climb, but you also have some pretty motivated people, some pretty ticked off people here.
Yeah, and I think between elections, this is the moment and the tool that citizens have to kind of signal their broad-based disgust, frankly, with the direction of the leaders at the legislature. And just one point of clarification, Representative Gress is the chairman of the Education Committee.
So one thing on recalls, they're incredibly difficult. You need 25% of the total vote for the past election. So, I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of signatures in a short period of time. You have 120 days to gather them. Even after the 120 days, we're talking about having a recall election right before the actual election next year, before these guys are reelected again. So it's more of a display of disgust, as Sam mentioned. It's more of a challenge to bring attention to an issue. But I do suspect this problem will be solved. Our legislature doesn't really waste a good crisis. They're just like, you know, other folks, they cram before the test. You know, good deadline. We've got a good deadline. Hopefully they'll come together and find the solution. The governor has said, bring me something that I can support. So, but the challenge is she probably needs to be at the table as well. This isn't just a keep bringing things back to me until you give me something I like. I think they need to sit down and negotiate.
Well, and that's one of the issues that Republicans have been criticizing the governor over, is that you're not at the table. You won't negotiate. You're not meeting with us. I wonder if that is telling in any way, talking about things like the budget or Prop 123, like things that are going to need negotiation and bipartisan buy-in. If Republicans are not happy with the governor's level of involvement on this, does that say anything about the other things we have to do this year, Paul?
Well, it also speaks to what do they determine as negotiation? I mean, what's the definition? Sure. Is. I mean, like, they're saying they're negotiating, quote unquote, but are they really truly negotiating as well? I mean, in some of these situations, you look at the position that they're starting at, it's also an unreasonable position. Mm. So really, we're so far apart on these things that I don't know if anybody's walking into this negotiations really with good intentions. And so it's really a level setting exercise. The things like this, it seems like it would have been an easy way to get some of these challenges like this out of the way so they could deal with the bigger problems. But they seem to want to fight about everything.
Yeah. And I would also just add that I don't think that is a universal belief that there is a lack of willingness to negotiate or even have an open door policy. If you ask other leaders or just look at the demonstrable results of bills that the governor has signed so far, I think that we'll talk a bit later about a member of the legislature who has had a very important piece of his own legislation signed while at the same time another bill that he marked as a priority piece of legislation vetoed. I think that there was probably some negotiations and some conversations that happened as a part of that. I think leaders in the housing policy world are very well aware of how open and forward the governor's office is in active negotiations, as in with land use and water policy. So I think that if you come to the table with integrity and honesty and openness, I think that would be received by the governor's office. And I think that if Chairman Livingston isn't receiving that, then maybe take a look at the motivations that brings them to the table and start there.
All right. That is Sam Richard. I'm also joined by Paul Bentz. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting and Paul Bentz of High Ground. So, Sam, you kind of teased this just before the break. State Representative Leo Biasucci of Lake Havasu City had two bills that went to the governor dealing with the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement. One was signed, one was not. The bill that was signed would prohibit ultra-processed foods from being in school lunches. The governor, though, vetoed a bill that would have prohibited people on SNAP, commonly referred to as food stamps, from buying soda with those benefits. Any surprises here?
No, none at all. I think that, the seeds of Mr. Biasucci's bill on healthy school lunches, you can even point back to shadows of administrations passed federally that kind of talked about the importance of healthy food and responsible diets starting at the public school level. And I think the other bill, what we're talking about, was very disparaging towards individuals that receive these SNAP benefits. And I think that no one necessarily disagrees that soda is something that we should limit in our diets. But I think the natural effect of signing that bill would have created a second class or an underclass of purchasers of these products. And I think that was the sole reason why the governor vetoed that.
Well, and Paul, I mean, on a very political level, one of these bills had bipartisan support and one did not.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of the challenge. It's ironic that the Republicans who have a president who has a Diet Coke button in the White House is the ones trying to ban soda for other individuals. It's also, it's something just sort of that limiting factor. While it is probably the healthy solution, it's just interesting that that's the type of issues that they're planning to push. On the healthy school lunch issue, it certainly did have bipartisan support. It certainly makes a lot of sense. The challenge is, where does that money come from for healthier items? Some of these items that we're talking about, ultra-processed, unfortunately, generally is a little bit cheaper. That's why people default to it, because schools are limited in their funding. And the other question I really have is, when it comes to education issues like this, are these the issues that are front of mind, top of mind, that people are caring most about when it comes to education? When we have, as Sam talked about, a fiscal cliff coming for one of our large education funding initiatives, Prop 123, that reaches expiration. We also have an aggregate expenditure limit that will come up year after year because there's no permanent solution to that. Are we really caring what's in the school lunches while we have these much, much bigger education issues to address?
It's an interesting point. I mean, there's certainly research that suggests that, students, for example, who are hungry, you know, who don't have breakfast or don't have a solid lunch don't learn as well. Like we learn better when we are our bodies are sated, as it were. I mean, but I mean, to Paul's point, like, are these really the top of mind education issues in Arizona?
Yeah, I would say that the funding definitely should be a, you know, an integrated part of every one of these conversations. Although I will say that I trust our legislative leaders to aspire to being able to walk and chew cinnamon bark at the same time.
maybe sugar-free gum.
That's right, sugar-free gum. But I think that, you know, that is an interesting conversation when we talk about, I mean, I think the count the last time I looked was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,850 unique pieces of legislation that were filed in this legislative session alone. Not all of those ideas are serious and, you know, really going to move the needle in important topics. Every now and again, you have an issue like this that, while important in kind of an esoteric way, also catches fire and brings people like, you know, RFK Jr. and celebrity doctors like Dr. Amen here to the Capitol to talk about the importance of moving these policies forward. But I do think that it isn't an either or, it can be a both end. And I think that that's also why you saw the governor sign this, not just because it had bipartisan support, but because this is a piece of a broader conversation in responsible education.
All right. So, Paul, the governor also has a bill on her desk dealing with Axon, which is the taser, the company that makes taser stun guns and body-worn cameras that police departments use. It's an interesting bill because Axon wants to build a new headquarters with a hotel and shops and everything, and that seems fine with everybody. Folks in Scottsdale, though, at least some of them, are not thrilled about the proposal to include a number of apartments on this land. They don't want it. The city council approved it. A number of residents collected signatures to refer it to the ballot. Axon CEO said, if we have to wait for this, we're leaving, we're out of here. This is a homegrown company. So now the legislature has come in and basically said, you can do this in Scottsdale. And it's a very interesting topic because it sort of pits economic development versus local control.
It's an incredibly challenging topic. I mean, the other thing that the residents are forgetting is that Axon could sell it to Amazon tomorrow and put a huge fulfillment center on that property without any additional vote, without any additional change. And so the question is, do they want it semi-trucks full of Amazon goods and drones leaving every minute, or would they rather the apartments? But, you know, as you mentioned, Axon's a multi-billion-dollar company, and certainly it was homegrown, and we don't have a ton of those homegrown corporate headquarters here. On the other hand, you're talking about local control and local government and ensuring that folks have a say in what's built in their communities. And it speaks to the broader housing debate in general. I mean, like, there's sort of this anti-apartment sentiment going around, but at the same time, you know, what should the local community be in charge of, and what sort of say should they have in what's being built in their neighborhoods?
And interestingly, Sam, the city council that approved this last year is not many of them are not still on the city council, and the many members of the new council don't love the proposal by Axon, and yet the entire city council and the mayor, who don't really agree on a lot of things, all signed a letter to the governor asking her to veto this.
Yeah, and I think that points to some of what Paul was talking about, that the complexity of the intersection of local control and really these national, if not international, conversations around business attraction. You know, we had governors of Texas and Florida really publicly talking about, hey, Axon, if it doesn't work out there, come on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have spots open. And if you know if those folks are being vocal, there's a dozen, if not, you know, three dozen invitations that they got privately. And I think that's really where a lot of the energy was focused on, not necessarily about this kind of fundamental or philosophical conversation around local control versus statewide concern. It was more of, what does this do? What chilling effect does this have in the economic development successes that Sandra Watson and the Arizona Commerce Authority have had over the last decade plus in bringing things like TSMC and the expansion of Intel and, you know, Amcor and all these incredible, really great announcements? What does that do to the pipeline of companies that are looking to Arizona?
Do either of you see this as a continuation of the state's attempts to sort of strong arm, I think, is too pointed a phrase, but sort of overtake cities in terms of what they are allowed and not allowed to do. We've seen this with housing. We've seen this with other issues. Paul, do you see this in the same category?
We see it in a lot of things. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's the challenge. But to Sam's point, what he was saying is, you know, a decade ago when we were doing polling, jobs was the number one issue facing the state. People, anything that had to do with jobs or job creation was incredibly popular. And then since that time, what we've seen is the state be incredibly successful in attracting new jobs, attracting major investment, and attracting international business. And if something like this is to go through and it is rejected, you know, this notion that Arizona is not open for business, when you add in other elements like the Coyotes deal being rejected and these things, you know, we get sort of that Florida reputation. What's going on in Arizona? You know, and I think we're trying to avoid the Florida reputation. So, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's going on here. But certainly the legislature is very interested, despite their hatred of the federal government and what the feds tell them to do. They sure do like to tell cities what to do.
Yeah. And I would just say, I think that maybe if the result of this kind of very multifaceted conversation results in an opening up of the dialogue on what is local control and what is statewide concern, I think that's a big win, because I personally believe that the city of Tempe or the town of Bisbee should be able to ban plastic bags if they'd like to, right? Or ban, you know, puppy mills in their malls, mm-hmm. right? But I do think that some things like business attraction and other issues should be of statewide concern, and a local municipality shouldn't say this multi-billion dollar company can't build what they want to build in our backyard.
Well, and quickly, guys, with the caveat that none of us are actually lawyers, nor do we play one on the radio, there is also the question that some have raised about, is this special, you know, interest legislation, you know, targeting one company, which is not allowed?
That's right. I think there are some big questions around that. And that's all I'll say, because as you pointed out, I'm not a lawyer.
I'm not a lawyer either. And it's certainly I suspect there'll be a lawsuit in the future no matter what.
Well, which kind of raises the question of, you know, if the part of the goal of this was to foreclose on the election and sort of get a final answer quickly, lawsuits, you know, the wheels of justice do not move all that quickly all the time. So I wonder if in some way Axon is still going to be sort of stuck in the state of limbo, not quite knowing what the final result's going to be.
Yeah, that will be an interesting thing to play out. But I do think that if the governor signs it, and I think that the clock has started because it has been transmitted to her desk. So mm-hmm. sometime by the, you know, middle of next week, we'll know what that decision is. And if Axon is given the opportunity to stay, I think that they'll fight tooth and nail to do so.
All right. So we have about 45 seconds left. Are either of you putting yourselves up as candidates to be the next coach of the Suns? Paul?
No, thanks.
It might just be a one-year gig, though.
Well, if I can get the three-year contract and only work 1 year, I'll take that.
All right, yeah. Sam?
I'm a baseball guy first and foremost, and Tory's doing a great job with the Snakes this year so far.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Sam Richard, Paul Benz, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how one man's love of history led to a collection of tens of thousands of presidential items. But first, back in February, after 24 years as a commissioner for the Arizona Commission on Boxing and MMA, Joe Pennington retired. His time on the commission began before most people even knew about MMA, which, in case you're one of those people, stands for Mixed Martial Arts. Pennington served under five governors during his tenure, during which he was particularly focused on strengthening safety regulations for boxers and MMA combatants. Shortly after his retirement, Pennington spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about how he found his love for boxing and how the sport has evolved over the course of his life as both a fan and fighter.
My bedtime was at 8 o'clock, except on Friday nights. And my father would let me stay up and watch the Friday night fights, the Gillette Friday night fights with him.
Our feature event here in Chicago Stadium is a 15-round match between Rocky Marciano and Jersey Joe Walcott for the heavyweight championship of the world.
That's how I began to enjoy boxing.
Wow. And were you interested in becoming a fighter yourself?
Well, in fact, I did. In college, I was the Golden Gloves light heavyweight champion in Memphis. But that was only for a year. I had to go on and try to complete my studies and not do all of the training required to be a boxer.
Yeah. Well, when you stepped into the ring after, you know, spending your youth watching it, What did you find about learning how to actually do it?
Actually, in the dorm where I was living, the guy across the hall, in the room across the hall, had been a Golden Gloves champion in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He would train me. We would go through sparring, etc. And in fact, the hardest I've ever been hit was by him with a left hook, 135-pound guy, and I saw scars like you would not believe. Didn't go down, but
I think if I got hit like that once, I would never touch a boxing glove again.
Well, I had to prove that I could endure it.
Wow. So what kept you interested in it even after you stopped fighting in earnest?
Whenever VCRs came out, a lot of guys bought the VCR so they could watch blue movies. and I bought the VCR so I could take boxing matches. And I've consolidated it down to where they're all on DVDs, but I've got 98 DVDs that are nothing but championship boxing matches with the 1 minute intermission or breaks between rounds edited out.
Wow. You know, you're making me think about, sometimes you'll hear, you know, film buffs talk about how they go back and watch Coen Brothers movies over and over again, or Robert Altman movies over and over again, because every time they watch them, they see something new. Is that what it's like watching fights for you?
Oh, yeah.
What are the kinds of things you catch on a repeat viewing that you might not have seen the first time?
Well, I mean, for example, Lomachenko, who is lightweight, has some remarkable footwork. He's Ukrainian, and his dad said that before he could learn to fight, he had to learn to dance. And so he did. Ukrainian folk music, folk dances, and his footwork is just incredible.
Wow. So it seems to me, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that there has always been this combination of factors around boxing culture. One is the elegance of it. You know, you mentioned that Ukrainian fighter who was trained as a dancer. The idea that there was this real craft and formality to it. But then there's also been, you know, lots of corruption and brutality over the years. And now there's folks like Jake Paul, who some people feel like is become a fighter just kind of as a stunt, but it's also brought a lot of new attention to the sport. What do you make of all that?
Focusing on Jake Paul and others, that is really a sports entertainment type of event. I consider it more like professional wrestling. It's not a totally staged event, but it's not hardcore competition.
Uh-huh.
If somebody put Jake Paul in the ring with a current light heavyweight or cruiserweight contender, I don't think that Jake Paul would last very long.
You think he might be seeing stars like you did?
Yeah, I think he might be.
And what about mixed martial arts? That to me, yeah, it sounds like you have some feelings about that.
Oh yeah, I've gained a great deal of respect for the combatants in mixed martial arts.
Do you think of it as a similar skill set to boxing, or do you see it as kind of a different way of competing physically altogether? I mean, just to offer a very rudimentary observation, I could imagine somebody who's like a real boxing nerd thinking, well, in boxing, you're only allowed to use your fists, whereas with mixed martial arts, everything's on the table. So you mentioned, you know, gaining respect for it. What has that journey been for you?
Well, at first, the fighters weren't that good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it as any sport, you start out with a new sport. The early participants in pickleball would go up, gently hit the ball over the net, and blah, 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 just like you see back in the early days of tennis. Well, today, they hit that ball, and it's coming at you pretty hard.
Right.
So, running. I recall when the 4-minute mile was finally broken. and how that was such a marvelous event. Well, how many 4-minute miles have been run since that time? I mean, high school track people are running almost 4-minute miles. Mm-hmm. It's just the improvement in the sport over time as we learn what the human body and brain are capable of doing.
Hmm. Well, so now you've retired, Joe, and you mentioned having this huge collection of DVDs that I'm imagining you'll have a little bit more time available to go back and revisit. If you had to pick one fight out of that collection that you feel like you go back to more than any other, could you say which one that is?
Terrence Crawford and Errol Spence Jr. a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Errol Spence Jr. had 3 belts, welterweight belts. Crawford had 1, and Crawford made him look like a competitor, not a champion, just a contender.
Beautiful counter left hands, and there's a right hook to the face of Spence by Crawford, and Crawford's accuracy just backing up Spence with these punishing shots.
It was just incredible. I mean, the difference in technique, the difference in speed, and the total domination that Crawford showed over Errol Spence just really reinforced to me that Crawford is probably one of the best boxers that the country has ever seen. And he'll be fighting Canelo Alvarez. I think it's in August. There's quite a bit of weight difference. One will have to come down, the other will go up. But that's a big, big money fight.
And I take it you'll be watching as a fan.
As a fan, I'll be watching, you bet.
All right. Well, Joe Pennington is the former commissioner of the Arizona Boxing and Mixed Martial Arts Commission, recently retired. And this has been a fascinating conversation, Joe. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. An exhibit in Santa Cruz County aims to showcase the heritage of that part of the state. Beyond Fronteras includes an exhibition at the Santa Cruz County Courthouse in Nogales, as well as an online component that focuses on areas like the region's people, history, and ecosystem. Carlos Parra is the coordinator and curator of the Beyond Fronteras project. He's also an assistant professor of history at the University of Arizona. He says the project has a specific focus on the humanities, targeted especially at middle and high school students. Parra was born and raised in Nogales and taught high school there. I spoke with Parra earlier about all this, and we started with the fact that this was more than a project to him. It was personal and dealt with his community.
No, I agree. Mark, you know, I'm born and raised in Nogales. I grew up on both sides, in both Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. And I taught there as well when I first worked as a high school teacher. So it was definitely really personal. And certainly coming of age in the period after 9/11, sort of these growing anxieties about what the border represents, right? You know, how do you define border security? Communities like Nogales, and I think many listeners might have families either down there in places like Douglas or in the, you know, out in Yuma, San Luis, they can kind of relate to this. You know, border communities have been sort of on the receiving end of negative stereotypes for quite a while, for pretty much a generation at this point, you know, if not longer. And when a lot of folks from the interior of Arizona, the interior of the U.S. come to places like Nogales or other Arizona border towns, there's these negative stereotypes. How dangerous is it here? You know, how safe is it here? And when a lot of these folks come in, they'd see that it's really, it doesn't quite live up to the hype that's presented in films like Sicario, you know, like for example. So one of the things that we really wanted to do, and as you correctly know, you know, it's a very personal way, was really present the best of who we are, you know, in terms of our community and in terms of its natural and its cultural history in Nogales in Santa Cruz County, and try to use that as a socially responsible way of having young people greater sense of self and a greater interest in the humanities.
So when you talk about using the humanities, using the environment, is that how you try to sort of move beyond the stereotype that a lot of folks have of this part of Arizona and you know, maybe help students understand, no, this is, yes, there is a border here, but we're about more than that?
Well, you know, for example, one of the Arizona State Content Standards in Social Studies looks at, you know, the westward expansion, which obviously includes the development of what became the U.S.-Mexican border. speaking as someone who sort of mentioned grew up in Nogales and taught there, when we grow up down there, you don't really understand those things. You grow up with this general knowledge that there was conflict between the two nations that led to the demarcating of the border, but we don't know exactly how it happened. And you know, it's hard enough to teach local history in places like Phoenix. I'm sure perhaps some of your listeners might be, you know, social studies educators in Phoenix, probably. It's really hard to find good material. But in a place like Phoenix, you have more people writing on it. You have, there's a little bit more scholarship. There's more resources that exist. In a place like Nogales, that's really not quite the case.
What surprised you about what the students found and what they came up with?
Sure. So one of the initiatives that we did to recruit, you know, the sort of student contributions, the student involvement into our overall project, our multimedia project, was an initiative called My History, Mi Comunidad, that we specifically framed in a Spanglish term, in Spanglish terms, because that's the real lingua franca for most people who grow up in Nogales in Santa Cruz County. It's not English that's your first language. It's not Spanish that's your first language. It's Spanglish. So we wanted something to represent that, and we felt that perhaps that might make our invitation to the students seem a little less intimidating. So when our students, who were primarily high schoolers, but we had quite a bit of middle schoolers contributing, for example, poems or artwork to us. I'll give you two quick examples. A significant contingent of students from the alternative high school in Nogales, Pearson High School, wrote poems reflecting on life growing up again in a U.S.-Mexico border town. A lot of them, some of them were in Spanglish. A lot of them wrote reflections, you know, short poems or short poems saying, you know, what they felt about growing up in Nogales, that they felt safe there, that they felt like a life of the love of life by being with their families. Some of them talked about, you know, their love of like Sonora and hot dogs. Some of them talked about crossing the border, you know, to go see their families in Nogales, Mexico. And it's just some really beautiful, heartfelt writings that our students shared with us. Some of them talked about how the border can also represent this really intimidating, menacing sort of aspect in our local culture that we have no control over. You know, that external forces, whether they're political forces or forces related to immigration, economics, really shape the way that our community functions. Another group of students also created paintings for us through one of the programs that we offered, and paintings celebrating the local natural and cultural history of Santa Cruz County, in which we have on permanent display at our exhibition. One of the most notable ones for me, there's two paintings in particular that these young people created. One of them celebrated the natural history of Santa Cruz County by having the endangered jaguar appear, as well as the Quatimundi, having depictions of birds that they're at the northern limit of their migratory sort of habitats, like the elegant trogon. Really beautiful, vibrant painting, as well as another painting that, in a similar painting that him and his students created, celebrating the arrival of the railroad in Nogales in 1882. So it was really beautiful to see kids literally investing themselves in terms of, well, there's the physical aspect of this, of actually creating these paintings, but there's also the larger sort of cognitive engagement at work here.
I'm curious about the cognitive aspect you mentioned, because it kind of makes me think back to what you said just a couple of moments ago about how when you were coming of age in Nogales after 9/11, mm-hmm. sort of grappling with, like, what does it mean to be from here and to live here? What does a border mean? It sounds like those are maybe in some ways the questions that you were encouraging, even if it was maybe sort of passively encouraging these students to also consider.
Well, we really want them to take it seriously. So, again, when you grow up anywhere, just like how similar to that, how when you consider how many Arizona or like Phoenix residents, maybe lifelong residents of our state, and have never been to the Grand Canyon, right? You kind of have to have like a structured educational opportunity to be able to really understand what these things really represent. And you do need, you know, this sort of like a, you know, mentioned like art appreciation sort of like learning, but there's also, you know, humanities or local history appreciation when it goes into how, you know, you know, so water doesn't grow in any other part of the world, you know, like for example, or how unique the Grand Canyon is. And similarly, when you grow up in a place like Nogales or like Douglas or like Yuma, San Luis, you take border fence for granted because it's, oh, that's just a regular part of growing up in this type of community. But to understand why was the border created in the first place in the 1850s? And when you have these negative images of the border, it's a really dangerous, chaotic place. It hides the longer history that's there and the more richer history. It's right there if you just dig a little bit beneath the surface. And we want young people to understand that, you know, how unique they are to grow up in a community where you have to be bicultural to be successful. If you really want to run a successful business in a place like Nogales, you have to be able to engage American and Mexican customers or audiences, as it were, you know, on their level. And we really want the kids to recognize that cultural capital so that when they grow up later on into the world, you know, it's that they can really recognize where they're coming from and really use that as a source of pride rather than a source of embarrassment, or rather than as a source of part of like a cultural deficit. We really don't want them to leave our community thinking that.
Carlos Parra is an assistant professor of history at the University of Arizona and coordinator and curator of the Beyond Fronteras Project. Most collectors of presidential items have a specific niche. Maybe it's campaign buttons, bobbleheads, or White House Christmas cards. Maybe they focus on a handful of select presidents or a certain time period. Not Steve Ferber. He just likes collecting what he calls pieces of history. Steve and his wife Lori own Lori Ferber Collectibles, and in the past 51 years, they've accumulated items from every single president and some presidential hopefuls. The rows and rows of tall shelves in their Scottsdale office are filled with medals, signed letters, campaign swag, and even strands of hair from past American presidents.
I started when I was a child in school, and first, like a lot of people, it was postage stamps, and that grew into political and presidential items. I think probably the first ones that I can remember was Franklin Roosevelt, souvenir from the inauguration. At any given time, we probably have 9,000 or 10,000 different items on our website. It's an accumulation of a wide variety of items. For instance, right now I'm looking at signed letters by President Harry Truman. Next to that is one of our favorite items is the error from the Chicago Tribune in 1948 that declared that Thomas Dewey had won the election versus Harry Truman. So it's the famous headline, Dewey defeats Truman. And we have several copies of that. It always amazes me that people spent, you know, 4 cents to buy that newspaper in 1948. And today it's worth between $2,000 and $3,000 each. Years ago, we had an editor from the Chicago Tribune call us, and he said he was looking to put it up in his office for people to see. And I asked him, well, I said, well, why don't you just get one from the Chicago Tribune? He says, I tried to. We don't have one. These binders are all paper items. Everything in this binder would be Jimmy Carter. These are press passes from his trips around the country and around the world. This is a ticket to his inauguration. These are tickets to the Democratic National Convention in 1980. This is a campaign flyer from Jimmy Carter. Oh, this is actually invoices to the Carter family peanut farm in Georgia. We are known for a lot of items from John F. Kennedy and also items from John F. Kennedy's assassination. For instance, this is a press kit for the media to what's known as the Texas Welcome Dinner, where President Kennedy was going to speak that night, and he was assassinated, unfortunately, earlier in the day, and they had to cancel the event. So the tickets, the invitations, the programs from the event are collected ravenously. People do collect hair from past presidents. a little difficult to know for sure the authenticity of those, but you rely on provenance, you know, proof that an item is from the family passed down from years to years, and there are authenticators that look at those types of things. This is a framed item from George Washington with pieces of George Washington's hair. Lock of hair of General George Washington given to Colonel Powell by Mrs. Powell, who had received it from Mrs. Custis L. Powell. So they actually knew who received it originally, who received it next, and the authenticator, who is very well known and very well respected, issued a certificate of authenticity about this document and this hair, I should say. There is not one political or presidential item in our house. Once we moved into the office, the agreement with Lori and I, which instigated by her, was there's just not going to be the clutter in the house anymore. So we've become minimalists at home. But in our office, as you can see, we're anything but. And of course, my wife reminds me all the time, how come you're still buying more things, even though you've still got three rooms of things you haven't listed yet? And I just tell her it's a disease. When you do this as long as we have, you just can't stop.
That was Steve Ferber, who owns Lori Ferber Presidential Collectibles with his wife, Lori. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.